Next speaker is Marty Cox, Chief Economist at Sandhag. This almost feels like old home week with all the staff there. Worked with Marty for 30 years at Sandhag, and I don't admit this, but it was a pleasure working with Marty because of, one, his enthusiasm as Assistant Chair for Housing for the Economy. But Marty's done a number of what I think are kind of groundbreaking economic, a way for economists to look at things in the San Diego region. The cluster work, there's residential land inventory, and it's a pleasure to see Marty here talking about the residential land inventory. And so, Marty?
Well, thanks for the introduction, Mike. I appreciate it. It's been a long time since you and I worked together. You know, it struck me is that I don't have a thing up here to control around, but I thought, you know, there's got to be a better word to click. So I was thinking, you know, what is it the San Diego region today really needs to happen to create some enthusiasm? I'm not like Go Padres. with all due deference to the LA crowd who's here. What do you think, Mike? Go Padres every time you want the slides to click? And for those who don't know, Mike is a rabid baseball fan. He and I on baseball items go back a long way, so if he hasn't told you stories about owning a baseball team on paper that he and I have owned in the past, you should corner one time. They're amusing. One of the things I want to mention about this, a lot of what Beth and Susan were talking about was all about Sandhag's sort of planning strategies, expected things to happen. And from time to time, believe it or not, some people disagree with this. They think, well, that's a great plan, but what's really going on out there? So actually, from time to time, we do stop. And we try to take a look at what's going on in the marketplace in order to find out whether or not what we're saying is going to happen is actually occurring on the ground. And that's what this particular study was all about. A little bit of background on it to give you some idea about what I mean. Back in the late 90s, when San Diego was in the middle of one of its large growth spurts, and run primarily by employment-related migration at that time, something we in dire straits of needs right now. But at that point in time, Sandhag and Sane came out with a set of forecasts says, we got 15,000 acres of employment land out there. We need to think about taking some of those acres and converting them over to residential, where there's a real shortage, obviously, because home prices are so high. The business community, especially the development community, was saying, wait a minute, we have a shortage of employment land. We don't have a lot of employment land on the ground today. So rather than fight it out in the press, we created a group made up of developers, Sandhag personnel, which primarily provided the technical support to put all the stuff in the GIS database. And then local jurisdictions also came on because they're sort of the referee between these because it's their plans we're talking about and the actual zoning or use of the parcels that we ultimately include into this inventory. As it turned out, we really did have 15,000 acres of employment land in the region at that time. But the point we did find out after the analysis is that only about 10% of that, a little less than 1,500 acres, could be used immediately. All the rest of it was really cold storage stuff. And so the development community was reacting to the location and the amount that could be used immediately in light of the rapid employment growth that was going on at the time. So out of that, we started a process that we go back periodically and take a look at employment, and now we have added in residential land. And so what I'll do today is sort of walk you through the employment side, show you where we are today. And I think I'd like to take credit for what you'll see on the employment side. I actually don't know whether it was, you know, our inventory and then our statement back out to local jurisdictions, there is a problem, right? And here's a way that we think is necessary to solve it. I'd like to take credit for all that, but I don't know if it's true. But more important to that is what we found on the residential side and how it ties in with the information you heard from both Susan and Beth. Go Padres. Okay, first of all, in terms of the location, to give you an idea, almost 99% of the population in San Diego lives in the western one-third, right? So that's where our inventory took place. the different colors in the zonal area there is represent whether we did employment and residential inventory in the same place, that's sort of the light yellow color. Then the darker gold color represents where there was only employment done. And then the green color, or actually the other way around, I think the residential only in the gold color, and then employment done in the green color. So there were some areas where we didn't do both, but a majority of the areas we did the inventory in both areas. Go Padres. Down here and go Padres. And hit this one about three times in a row. There we go. Briefly, in terms of background, we actually went down to the parcel level. And so the first thing we took an inventory was either you're developed or you're under construction. That's the pumpkin color up here. And then the next three represent those opportunities for development. And we created three categories: immediately, short-term, long-term. The immediately is within 1 year. The short-term was within 2 years. And the long-term was 3 years or longer. And this particular one is for City of Santee, and it's got most of the kinds. You can see a majority of out there by Mission Gorge Road is in sort of the blue colors, which is the sort of up to 2 years, but not less than one. The other thing we did, you can see a little bit of red there. You know, there's a lot of redevelopment going on. This red happens to represent a change to a non-resident or non-employment type, right? We'd be moving from employment to something else. We'd leave the inventory when it was finally redeveloped. And so we wanted to keep track of that, that stuff that was leaving the inventory, and it was planned for another purpose or use. And then also, and this was the interesting part, there were actually probably about, and same is true today, over 1,000 acres of unusable land in the inventory. And remember now, this is the development community saying to us that you've got these small land, splitters of land that when you add them all up, you know, they come up to 1,000 acres, but individually, they're really not useful. And so part of the thing we found was that the information that we were using to convey what our inventory was really wasn't accurate, right? We were overstating the actual inventory that was usable in the region. And I think the benefit of having the development community sit at the table with you, right, and give you their opinion on a very specific parcel from their perspective is important. Now, it doesn't mean you got to run out and get rid of it, right? But it does give you a little bit of food for thought about whether or not you want to correct your general plan or the amount of acres you think you have available that then your city council depends upon in order to help make its decisions. Okay, go Padres. Now, in terms of where we are today, there's about 10,000 gross acres of employment land in the region, and that matches up with the inventory done at the end of the 90s and about 15,000 acres. So we've consumed or converted about 5,000 acres of employment land during that time period. I put this into sort of two categories. The first is the developable employment land of those three that I mentioned, the immediately, short-term, long-term. And you can see today there's over 2,000 acres. And remember I said before there was about 1,500 acres, right, of immediately available. So we've actually added immediately available land to our inventory. Like I said, I like to take credit for that. We were short last time, but I think perhaps it's a lot to do with the lack of market demand today and the lack of development that's going out there, that we've captured a little bit of that getting land ready and preparing for development, then it sort of disappears on you, your market goes away, and so you're left with this land that can actually be used immediately. But here you can see a majority of this stuff is really long-term available. So in that sense, it's really not much different than what we found last time. A lot of land in cold storage, although we do have a little bit more in immediately available. The other side over there represents the vacant redevelopment side, and that is sort of the status of the acres today. And of course, a majority of that, 90% of it, is in vacant, and only 2,000 or so odd acres are redevelopable, right? That's where there's something on it today, right? We're gonna redevelop it and use it for employment land in the future. Okay, go Padres. Okay, where it's located, this was the other issue that the development community had. And basically, 2 points here. You can see that about 50% of this is located in sort of what we call our South County. And that's Otay, Otay Mesa, and the Chula Vista area. the lakeside area is the Upper San Diego River Improvement Project. I don't know if that's ever gonna develop, but it's still on the books as being available. But, you know, that's one of those things we probably should think hard about, whether or not we really include it into an inventory of available. It's one of those ones that's really questionable. But back in the first time we did this stuff, we had, well, I'll get to that in just a minute, not yet. But anyway, it is still concentrated in terms of gross acres in our South County. Thanks, go Padres. Okay, this is the immediate available, and you can see again, pretty concentrated, but a lot different than what we found last time. The immediately available, more than half of it in the late 90s was located in really Otay Mesa. And so of the 1,500 acres, 800 plus of those were in one place, down in Otay Mesa. And today, although it's still heavily concentrated in South County, we've also got some acres spread out in North County, so it's much more diverse than it was in the past. We have opportunities that are immediately available up and down the county rather than just concentrated in one place. And again, go back to that point we made earlier when the development community was trying to tell us something, I would say the local jurisdictions listened and then went ahead and prepared this employment plan to take advantage of employment growth as it begins to occur. Okay, on the residential side, and again, going to hit about four times if you would, same kind of inventory structure here. Pumpkin color is existing or under construction. Then the three types of development categories, immediate available, short term, and then long term. Now there is one here that's a lot different than the employment side, and that's the plant mixed use. And it plays a very important role, and I'll talk about that as we get into the presentation a little bit more. And then there's also some existing residential that will be non-residential by the end of it. We'll convert from this particular land use to a different type, so we try to keep track of that. Then the difference between single, multiple, as you can see, the one that's got the black spots is the multifamily, and so those without the black spots are the single family. Okay. Okay, now, in terms of total acres, for those of you who are familiar with San Diego, we have over 456,000 acres of residential land in the region today that are actually available for development. Same type of inventory distribution that I used last time. One closest to me talks about immediately, short-term, long-term, and you can see the less than 1% of the acres out there today, about 3,300, are actually immediately available for development. About 23,000 in terms of short-term, that's up to 2 years, same concept, within 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years longer. But a majority of it is in that long-term available. The other side talks about the type of land or the status. And here I've got three categories, it's just two. And at the very top, I have that mixed use, planned mixed use category that I talked about a little bit earlier. And you can see there's about 3,800 acres of it. Then the redevelopment side, almost 10,000 acres of it, but a majority of it still within the vacant category. Go Padres. Now here, most of you knew this already, that a majority of the 456,000 acres we have is in the unincorporated area, and about 11% is in the incorporated area. Go Padres. Okay, now once we take a look at that, again, sort of gross acres, long-term available, break it into pieces again, and then show incorporated versus unincorporated, we have about 54%, more than half, located in the incorporated areas. This is just of the immediately available, right? We're focusing on that because that's usually the next, what's gonna develop next. Somebody's went in, developed plans, you know, created streets, put in sewer, whatever you gotta do to prepare this stuff somewhere in the entitlement process. And within 1 year could put it to work. So over 54% of that immediately available is in the incorporated areas. Go Padres. Now, and what Beth talked about was a very specific forecast about the number of units that we think will actually be developed through 2050. Mine is a range because behind all of this are the sort of general plan ranges, and so that's what this represents. The reason Beth has to give a very specific number is because when we're building roadways or infrastructure, things like that. They asked for a very, they asked for a very specific number to size all this stuff up as opposed to this range. They just can't, engineers have trouble with ranges. You give them an engineer, they give them a number they can deal with it, but you give them a range, they don't, they're lost. So best forced into to give them actual numbers. The point here, we've got sort of capacity somewhere between 330,000 units and 486,000 units can be built. And again, back to Susan's point about multifamily, somewhere between 52% to 57% would be multifamily. Remember, this is all of total acres, right? Including the unincorporated community I talked about earlier. Go Padres. Okay, putting this thing into another kind of category breakout, this is where some of the analytics begins to take place. Just in terms of acres, I've got something up here called the, in the pipeline, then redevelopment mixed use, and then in vacant, 90% in the vacant acres. I'll talk about more just a minute about what I mean by in the pipeline. But then there's another 3% or so of those acres in mixed use. On the far right is the units. And you can see that a majority of the units are either in this category called in the pipeline or redevelopment, only 20% in the vacant category. So we're going to put 80% of the units on 10% of the land. And so all of a sudden things change around, right? And I'm talking about this inventory of 456,000 acres, a lot of it in the unincorporated communities. Now all of a sudden the reality of it is you're going to put 80% of your units on 10% of the land. And then all of a sudden that type of land begins to play a much more important role in what your planning strategies are than they were before. And a majority of that land is not vacant. Okay, go Padres. Now to give you an idea of sort of a separate database we use, now we'll move away from that committee that we put together of the development community and the local land use agency staffs and SANDAG. But now we'll take a look at a sort of an inventory that Market Point Realty does. They track building permit activity from beginning to end in all communities throughout San Diego. So somewhere in the entitlement process, either at the very beginning of it, when you first walk up to the building permit or sort of submit your application, I'm really serious about building something, to wherever you are before the occupancy permit is actually provided, there's 130,000 units in that pipeline. And that's what the previous slide, when I said in the pipeline, somewhere in this entitlement process are 130,000 units. I found that surprising in San Diego. This was pretty close to like 10 years worth of growth of housing units based upon what best numbers are indicating, but somewhere in that pipeline. Now, this pipeline, I think, is a little bit elastic depending upon the market. Some of those units, even if they were close to being ready to be occupied, I sort of stuck in that pipeline for a little while the market sort of digests all of the foreclosures and high cost of borrowing and things like that before they come out the entire pipeline. So it's probably a little clogged right now. Not much movement going on with those 130,000 units. But the second point here, I think just as importantly, and this goes to the Susan's point, of those units, those 130,000, 82% are in the incorporated area. Now remember, this is not a planning concept. This is not SANDAG saying we think. This is somebody walking up to the building counter, right? Taking out plans. So 82% of these units that somebody wants to build is actually located in the incorporated area. Then more surprisingly than that, and in line with what SANDAG is planning to occur, over 80% of that 82% is in the incorporated area. And so some correspondence between what's really going on out there and also sort of the planning strategies. And this sometimes comes as a real surprise to the development community because they don't like cooperative. You know, they really want to develop on vacant land. They really still believe that. But when they see all this, it does give them a moment for pause about what actually they're asking for in relation to what's being planned. So they want to take a look at Russ Fulham's database to make sure he's got everything correct. But so far, and this was done almost a year and a half ago or so, we haven't really heard much back again that the information we gathered out of those two sets of data is inconsistent with what's really going on. Go Padres. Now, one of the things here that Susan mentioned was sort of SANDAG and jurisdictions attempt to what I would call channel growth, right, from the, make sure that it goes into the incorporated areas, right? Away from the sort of environmentally sensitive, unincorporated communities. And we're gonna really try to channel that into the incorporated areas. And what we have in mind was that we tried to identify where to best accommodate this. And those are called these smart growth opportunity areas. So they're supposed to provide the best opportunities and perhaps the least costly method of accommodating, right? Great deals of transportation capacity, great deals of public facility kinds of things. Not that you don't have to make any improvements, right? That's not the point here. But the improvements would probably be less in these areas, right? If our objective criteria is correct, then it would be just allowing it to develop anywhere. So we've tried to do a good job in that, work with the local jurisdictions. And I think the development community likes this idea, because we're no longer are we saying no growth. What we're doing is we're saying, look, we want it to occur in very specific places. First in the incorporated areas, and then secondly, in these areas we call smart growth opportunities. Go Padres. Now, what we did find, you know, because now we have this data, right, of 130,000 units, where developers really want to that development to occur, and there's a little bit of a mismatch between these smart growth opportunity areas and where the developers have indicated where they would like to put it. So I still think we have some work to do, right, on the part of local governments to try and match these things up closer. I don't think we've done a good enough job tying together, for example, the ease of development inside these areas. If we really want it to go there, we're going to have to make it more competitive, right, than elsewhere. Because otherwise, that developer is going to look for that least costly, more competitive place to put it from a broad range of perspective that they use. One thing I like to sort of point out here, you can think of your mind, redevelopment agencies are really advocates for growth in their redevelopment area. And they work with the development community. Not only that, but they take on a lot of responsibility in terms of getting through the environmental process and permitting exactly what type of development they would like to occur. So the developer sees that and he says, you know, I'd really like to build that. I think I can make sense out of it. And then probably within a year, year and a half or so, right, you need to start getting this building up. If you don't have the public sector sort of do the environmental process, do all the public outreach with the neighborhoods and straighten out that process, it's probably going to take them 5 to 7 years to get through the process. So here you got some options that the public sector sort of takes on the role, right, of preparing the smart growth opportunity areas for development. Doing all the heavy lifting of the EIR work and all the heavy lifting of the public outreach, right, taken off the shoulders of the development community, they're on the shoulders of the public communities, right? So you're more a redevelopment agency, you're just not in a redevelopment area. Take that role on yourself, right, and prepare this. You probably get that to be a competitive place for development to occur, right? Because you can get it to the market within probably a year, year and a half versus 5 to 7 years. Now, part of the reason why, you know, the cost of construction and housing is so high is because there's a huge risk for developers to do that, right? Long lag teams between they actually start the process, whether or not they actually end up with what they thought they would in terms of a project, and then what the market looks like at the other end of that. There's a huge risk. They could miss an entire cycle. And I think part of this 130,000 units I talked about missed the cycle. Right? If they knew this recession was going to come, it was going to be as severe as what it is to the construction industry, they wouldn't have started that. There's a lot of them who are either going broke or having to turn their land back over, or the properties have gone to foreclosure. They wouldn't have started this. There's no doubt about it. So the risk is huge. Right? And so all I'm saying here is that the public sector could step up, make these smart growth opportunities much more competitive, and play a role in directing that growth, right, where you actually want it to occur. And then allow the development community to do what it does best, and that's the build part. What it doesn't do best is work with the neighborhoods and do the EIR stuff, right? That's always a head butting contest that way. Now, one of the other things that we found out after we sort of put all this database together was that it had a broad interest for it, especially the immediate available stuff where brokers, developers, etc. would like to take a look at where all this stuff is located. So we created a web-based analytical tool that basically not only showed you parcel by parcel where all this stuff is located, but we combined it with information that Sandag produces all the time in terms of population numbers, housing numbers, growth numbers, things like that. So once you find your parcel, it's immediately available, it's within a mile of the airport or near a rail port or something like that, then you can also do a profile about what our projections are, a mile, 2 miles, whatever out, in terms of distance from the site. They give you some idea about what the expected growth in population and employment and that kind of stuff might be from there. And so it's an analytical tool, a web-based analytical tool with a GIS mapping capability with it that's we found has been pretty useful. A lot of people use it in the region today for different types of purposes. And with that, let me stop. And am I allowed to only two questions or comments?
Here's what I'm going to do. The next session is where you get an opportunity to ask questions of all the panelists. So what I'm going to do is what we can do is just move into that session. So if you've got questions of Marnie, Susan, or Beth, we'll take about 10 minutes worth of questions. So questions for Marnie first, and then Patrick, you can ask your question.
Marnie, that Ready system seems like it might be a great tool to support realistic capacity for the sites inventories that we have to do in the housing elements. Is that going to be updated on a regular basis so that jurisdictions can use that and maybe coordinate our site inventory for the entire region and maybe make progress with HCD?
Yeah, 2 points about the update. Sandag's database's development occurs is updated periodically as the permits are taken out, developed, and units are occupied. All that stuff will be added into the Ready database periodically. What really is more difficult and less updated is those categories of immediate available, short-term, long-term, because that requires sort of getting together as a sort of committee, developers, public sector, to talk about the inventory itself and what belongs where. That right now is probably on about a 3-year cycle, something like that. So we just finished it in 2008-09. So it's sort of those two big pieces. The Sandag database itself in terms of land use, periodically updated. The other one's on a 3 to 5 year cycle.
Okay, cool. Questions now
from anybody besides Patrick. Have a question.
Now just a couple questions. Is the 80% that we talk about as being multifamily, I believe that's referring to attached units, not the 30 units per acre.
Right.
And do we know what the density range, as low as that goes on, that you're talking about, or the average density of the 80% multifamily?
I don't recall off the top of my head. We've been starting to compile some of that information as background for the RENA process. So some of it falls into lower density ranges, 15 to 19, 20 to 29. Quite a bit of it, because much of the city of San Diego's density is at higher ranges, so quite a bit of it is in 50 plus. But we could put that information together and send it out.
My other question is, when Susan, you were talking about the RENA number and the distribution process, when you look at all the information of where 30 units per acre is, sometimes, well, it is, the RENA numbers seem to be a number game because we're trying to distribute that throughout all the communities. But sometimes that may not reflect employment or the sustainable communities. And I know in our guidelines we're going to be considering those things. But I guess just in the future, as we move forward with future RENA process, we should look at it from a planning standpoint and not simply a numbers game that everyone gets their share. Everyone should get their share, but we seem to say everyone gets 40% of their numbers are lower income. And that may not fit the sustainable communities nor the employment areas. Just more of an observation or comment.
Right.
Okay, other questions?
Marnie, could you go over just some of the criteria with the committee on how you establish short-term, immediate, long-term, why you chose 3 years, 1 year, 2 years, stuff like that?
Yeah, Actually, it was a conversation that we held as a committee, right? And the development community was explaining to us sort of this entitlement process that they have to go through for development. Some people knew it, you know, who have been on building permit counters or planners for a long time, economists. We just assume it gets developed. We don't ever talk about how. But it was important then to figure out the characteristics of the entitlement process matched up with these time frames. And so the development community walked us through, local jurisdiction staff that were helping us evaluate that, agreed that these particular characteristics with the entitlement process meant that you had gone along far enough, you're probably within a year of development, you know, 2 years away or 3 years or longer, that kind of a thing. So it's all built into the entitlement process, sort of each step of the way, as the developer who shows up at the counter works his way through towards completion of his development. That's the way they were designed.
Marty,
all of those definitions are out there on the website underneath this ready system, as well as the report itself is on the Sandag website, and you can take a look at those different definitions and the characteristics of the entitlement process under which each of these categories fall.
I was going to ask a question. Is it possible to re-aggregate the data to show land available during the housing element period?
Yes. Remember, Mike, there was a limitation of that 2 to year. Remember, everything else is 3 years. Okay.
Susan, given the experience of this last housing element in terms of how many of those low-income units were actually created, what assurance do we have after these folks do all this work that we're going to have any more low-income units in the next cycle, especially with the constrained financial resources?
I think we don't have any assurance. I mean, I think that what Housing Element does best and is really focused on is the availability of land that jurisdictions can make available for attached or multifamily housing, because that's kind of the underpinning of being able to use the different resources that might be out there, the funding that's out there, whether it's state funding or federal funding or, you know, agency funding. I think the way the state looks at it, and Paul will elaborate on this, is that the local jurisdictions have control, that do the housing elements have control, land use control. They have the ability to zone. They don't have as much ability to actually get housing built. I mean, they have some limited ability if they have a redevelopment agency because they have money. But, you know, it's the housing element law is really directed more at planning than it is about production. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is, you know, up for debate, but that's really what housing element law is focused on, is making sure that the zoning is there, that the land use is there, and then I think what's left up to local jurisdictions and then maybe to all of us is local jurisdictions can adopt inclusionary ordinances. They can make density bonus, you know, they can adopt density bonus ordinances that are clear about what, you know, how affordable housing can get built through those. They can adopt second unit or accessory unit ordinances that make building those types of units easier. And then from the funding standpoint, you know, the Prop 1C and Prop 46 funds, as you well know, are expended or just about expended, so there are people working at the state level on a permanent source of funding for affordable housing, but given the financial situation we're in, I think that that's going to be a long shot for a while. But I think we've really seen over, you know, with these numbers that I gave, which, you know, 16-17% construction of lower income housing, I think that's with all these resources that have been available, the bond money, the tax credit money, the redevelopment tax increment that's probably been pretty high. So I think we're facing a situation where we're not going to have as much money as we've had in the past. And so actual production is probably going to go down unless some, you know, dramatic actions are taken.
Let me add another, comments look at it a little bit differently. One, there have been tremendous gains over the last 2 or 3 years in terms of prices, right? We've gone from $500,000 down to $350,000 somewhere today. So how do you ensure that you don't lose those gains? How do we ensure home prices don't ratchet back up to $500,000 in a short period of time, and you're back to the point where 5 to 10% of the households can afford the median priced house? I would think that those gains were hard to come by, and if they got out of whack before, and I'm not gonna argue that the financial industry wasn't a part of that, but I think our own processes play a role in that, right, in that problem. So I think a little bit of work on our part to make sure that we make areas where we want growth to occur more competitive is a part of the answer to this, so we don't lose the gains that we had over the last 5 years or so. The second piece of that, I think part of the reason why homes are so unaffordable is job quality. I mean, incomes are not keeping up either. It's a combination of factors there, prices rising, the ability to afford the other one. So we have to sort of recognize that what we invest in, right, that generates jobs is sort of reflective of the ability to afford. And so as we make choices with limited public resources about what we're investing in, you have to keep in mind that those are the jobs that then will be generated that we fill those places, right, and the incomes that go along with them. Mm-hmm. And good example of that, we keep expanding the convention center, right? You're not going to get pharmaceutical drugs produced by a convention center. It's not going to happen, right? You're going to lock yourself into levels of employment and skills necessary to take those jobs, right, that we have built to match up with that infrastructure that we put together. So limited public resources in order to sort of build the foundation for high value added jobs is a piece of that.
I had another question related to Beth and your presentation on the demographics. I thought it was really interesting. It had to do with the household size. I'm a little new to how this planning goes on in the background in terms of generating the future projections. But when you look at household size, do you look at that in terms of, is there a household size that is an ideal number for quality of life? Do you look at it like planning towards a goal of a household size, or do you look at what you think the household size is going to be based on the market?
It's a really good question, and one that's a little bit complicated, and I'll try to break it down. There are two ways that we look at household size. So the first and easy answer is that we don't have a planning target for the right household size. There are reasons to think that if people have choice and they want to live in smaller households, well, then you want to plan for enough housing to support that. But there's also reason to think that larger household sizes maybe aren't such a bad thing, because if you have 3 or 4 people living in a house, whereas you know if you have 2, then you need 2 houses. If you have 4 people living in a house, then you only need 1 house. And so it's more efficient in terms of energy use and water use and preserving habitat. So there's not a right answer. So what our forecast does is it looks at demographic trends. And what we've seen is Hispanic families, even second and third generation, tend to have multi-generational households, larger sizes. Non-Hispanic white families tend to have slightly smaller households, but their kids are moving back in. And so we look at the characteristics. It's called the headship rate. So at each age and gender group and race and ethnic group, what's their propensity to form a household? So if every 2 people form a household, the headship rate is 0.5. If every single one of us had our own house, the headship rate would be 1. 2 people, it's 0.5. If it's 4 people in a house, the headship rate is 0.25. And so we look at how those trend over time, and what we've seen is that the Hispanic headship rates are coming down a little as socioeconomic status goes up, but that in general, they tend to be larger households. And that the 15 to actually all the way up to 34-year-old groups across every race and ethnic category, kids are staying at home longer with their parents. They're finishing college and moving back home. Or they move out for a few years, and then, you know, especially with the job market the way it is, they move back home for a year or two. And so those headship rates are going down. As you get older, your headship rate goes up, especially in the oldest age groups. You're more likely to live alone, but then you get into the oldest point, and then you're more likely to live in a group quarters, convalescent home kind of facility. So we look at all of those trends, and that's where the average headship rate piece comes from, or the average household size piece comes from.
Just a follow-up. So, Marion, now you've explained that through the committee, you know, and progress in the entitlement process, you figured out immediate, short-term, long-term. I'm wondering also what type of criteria you use to decide whether something is immediate, whether something is short-term, or whether something long-term. And part of what I'm doing is trying to figure out how we look at non-vacant sites and potential for redevelopment and how you looked at it and if there's connections there to assist local governments in their updates.
Make sure I understand the question. Is it just redevelopment that you're interested in?
Yeah.
One of the things that we went into the meeting with a predisposed position that redevelopment would probably end up in immediately available. It ended up quite the opposite. And it wasn't so much the development community, but the local jurisdiction staff who weighed in on that and said, there's no way, right, a redevelopment piece can actually be done in your immediate available short term. It really belongs in long term because the process is so cumbersome and slow to get there. So the only way you would end up in immediately or short in a redevelopment area is if there was something in progress. Otherwise, all that redevelopment stuff was really sort of long term. Yeah, which was very interesting to us, that there was that much, lag when you have an advocate, a redevelopment agency, right? And someone shows up at the front door, it's gonna take them that long to get through the process. So it was kind of interesting for us that the local jurisdiction staff recommended we put it to the long term.
So you said something in progress, so does that mean zoning in progress? Does that mean an actual project in progress?
It's typically a project. And keep in mind now, when we're working with the development community, we probably have a representative from the group who's doing the work there and then understands where that project is in the process. That when we did this, the outreach to the development community was pretty extensive, where they would send us people who specialize in, you know, available space, residential and employment from different parts of the region, whose job it is to understand the inventory that's available, right, so it can meet its customers' needs, which worked out really well for us because that's something that from the public sector we don't really pay much attention to because, you know, we get paid to actually sell or lease, right, like they do. So understanding the inventory from their point of view became very important. And that's why we were able to get that information.